I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 3rd of March. This hour of the program, Muslims in southeastern Wisconsin and across the country and beyond this country have been reporting a spike in anti-Muslim rhetoric and incidents in the weeks since the deadly terrorist attacks by Islamic radicals in Paris and in California. Othman Atta, the executive director of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee, says, "I think the climate is becoming much more negative. I think it's worse than after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Here to explain what the attacks have been and to talk about Islamophobia in the world, we'll have two guests with us during the course of the hour. Arun Kundanani writes about race, Islamophobia, political violence, and surveillance. He has an interesting background because he was born in England and raised in England, but he moved to the United States in 2010. His latest book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terrorism. He is now living in Harlem. He's also the author of The End of Tolerance, Racism in 21st Century Britain. He's a former editor of the journal Race and Class, and he is teaching at New York University. Janan Najib will join us a little bit later this hour. She's a founding member and the current president of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition, and she has been a spokeswoman for Milwaukee's Muslim community to media outlets and government outlets. She's a microbiologist by profession, and she will outline some very disturbing incidents of discrimination here in the greater Milwaukee area. All hour, we are welcoming your phone calls, as we always do, and here is how you reach us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we always love to read your comments, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Arun, thank you so much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. Let's start with your response to Othman Atta's comments here in Milwaukee, the executive director of the Islamic Society. He says, "I think the climate is becoming much more negative. I think it's worse than after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Do you agree?"
Yeah, I mean, that's the pattern we're seeing across the United States. It's actually, until the last few years, you wouldn't have seen anything like this at all. And the uptake in Islamophobic violence actually happens around about 2009, 2010, from then on. So, in fact, after 9/11, you had George W. Bush, in fact, say that... he made some very positive comments about, Islam being a mainstream American religion and encouraging people not to demonize Muslims. And in a way, the reaction after 9/11 was less dangerous within the United States. Obviously, we then had a war in Iraq, which was a different matter. But it's really from 2010 onwards that you get this kind of uptick, and then that's escalated even more in the last few months. And so what's interesting about that is that it means that what we're seeing is not really about a spontaneous reaction to major terrorist incidents. It's coming from somewhere else, because otherwise, how would you explain the uptick from 2009-2010?
I assume that you're talking about political rhetoric the last couple months, and I'm wondering what has been the result of, let's have a ban on Muslims coming to the United States, what effect that has had on people who are Muslim here in the United States. Have we kept track of that?
Well, we don't have very good measures of incidents of violence or abuse across the country. The FBI keeps some statistics on that, but everyone by and large agrees that they are incomplete. What we can go on is the kind of mood and the feel that you have at the community level, and obviously since the last few months that mood seems somewhat different. The comments from Trump are part of a much broader trend, actually. I mean, we tend to focus very much on Trump and his comments about banning Muslims from the United States, but he was not by no means the only, kind of leading candidate who was saying things like that.
Mm-hmm.
it's really a problem across our political culture, and it's not something that the Democrats have necessarily stood up to or provided an alternative to either. I think that what Trump was actually doing in his rhetoric was actually just making explicit in his words what is kind of already implicit in the way that we think about Muslims in our policy terms. So, you know, in policy terms, we've already done a lot of the things that he was calling for. We already put, most mosques in the United States under surveillance. We already deported thousands of people after 9/11 simply because they were Muslim. We already were saying that we would have hardly any Syrian refugees come to the United States because they're perceived to be Muslim. So, you know, that was these things were already policy before Trump started talking about them.
Mm-hmm. You have an interesting perspective because you're from the UK and you have written about so-called multiculturalism in England. I'm wondering if we can do an international comparison. You've said that it's never really been about distributing power more evenly. It's about having selected community leaders coming to represent ethnic identities in a way that is, again, reminiscent of the old colonial arrangements. Give us an idea of what's been happening in the UK on these very issues.
Well, in the UK, you have a larger percentage of the population that identifies as Muslim. Most of them come from South Asia, come from the history of Britain's colonial relationship in India. That's you know, the kind of path that's led to their migration to the UK. And so their kind of reception and settlement into the UK has been kind of framed very much through that imperial history that Britain has. Those communities have seen themselves as sharing an experience with other communities of colour in Britain that had that same colonial history. So people from the Caribbean who were also colonised by Britain, people from South Asia who are not Muslim, Hindus and Sikhs and so forth. And so all of those communities actually have quite a powerful history within Britain over the last half century of trying to challenge those perceptions that they've inherited through that history and kind of making Britain into a country that at least to some extent now has addressed that history and addressed some of that racism that came with it. And so the Muslim population in Britain has a strong experience of actively campaigning on this stuff. Because the difference in the United States is, in the United States, roughly about a third of the Muslim population is actually African American. And so they have their own specific history that's very much part of the history of black people in general in the United States. And then the other two-thirds are the result of immigration from 1965 when the immigration laws were changed. And so those communities are very diverse. They come from all around the world, you know, Southeastern Europe, the Middle East, East Asia, South Asia, North Africa, East Africa, et cetera. And those communities, by and large, were allowed into the United States because they were highly qualified, and there was a kind of Cold War competition for their skills in the 70s and 80s. And so, by and large, those kinds of people were able to settle quite comfortably in the suburbs in the United States and lead reasonably comfortable lives until the 1990s, or at least till 9/11, when suddenly they were seen as the enemy. Mm-hmm. And so for them, they're kind of being thrown into this situation of suspicion without having any history in their community of civil rights activism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big difference with Britain, where there was that history.
You have, and let's talk about the United States now. I'm wondering if this is happening here. Since 9/11, you say Muslims have had to pay over and over for crimes committed by fanatic Islamist militants. Human rights have been snatched. People are being watched. Many people, and I'm wondering where this is happening, are being tortured and murdered by Western states. In the war on terror, anything goes.
To be honest, I'm not sure that's a quote of mine, but I by and large agree with that. I wrote an article that came out a couple of weeks ago for The Intercept, which is about the case of a British Muslim called Mehdi Hashi, who was just over the last 3 or 4 years detained in East Africa by a local government that had been that was working with the US government to do that, and he was forced to watch torture. And other people were tortured that he was with, and he was then rendered from East Africa to New York and held in solitary confinement for 3 years before he even came for trial. So, you know, that is a case of someone who was subjected to torture, subjected to rendition under the Obama administration, when we were told that those things would no longer happen. So I'm afraid, you know, a lot of journalists have stopped paying attention to these issues.
Yes, they have.
But they do go on.
Mm-hmm. What is the, it's kind of a large question, but as we try to figure out how to stop a spread of militancy and terror, what is the best strategy, and what are we missing in trying to keep people from joining militant Islamist, and it's sort of hard to put Islamist before that because they're militant terrorist groups. Are we off the mark in how we're conducting an anti-terror campaign?
Well, you know, we've been doing this war on terror now coming up for 15 years, and we have not reduced terrorism. We've actually just increased the amount of terrorism in the world. So we are definitely doing something wrong on a fundamental level. In my opinion, we have basically failed to understand what is going on here. We tend to always assume that the problem that we are dealing with is an extreme religious ideology, right? And so we have this idea that religious fanaticism captures the minds of Muslims and turns them into terrorists. And so that, if that's the analysis, then of course the solution is to prevent that ideology, however you define it, from circulating. And that's essentially the method that's been applied since 9/11. Use whatever means possible to prevent ideologues from expressing their dangerous ideas, and prevent those ideas from circulating. It doesn't work because the problem is not the ideas. The problem is that we don't acknowledge our own role in fostering this ongoing violent conflict between Western governments and groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Shabab, etc. We are part of that cycle of violence as well. We like to think that, you know, that ISIS is barbaric in the way that it kills children and attacks hospitals and journalists and so forth. Well, we also kill children and bomb hospitals and kill journalists. So I think the first step is to acknowledge, you know, our own violence and the way that that fosters climates around different parts of the world. It fosters contexts around the world where violence becomes more likely in response. Second thing that we can do is, change our relationships with some of the authoritarian regimes in the region of the Middle East that are part of the problem here. You know, our very close alliance with Saudi Arabia that we conduct because we think it's essential for securing oil is encouraging the most reactionary regime in the region, and one that has, you know, circulated and sponsored many of the worst kinds of jihadist groups in Syria and elsewhere. So, you know, partly this is about those kind of foreign policy alliances that we make. And obviously, you know, we the long history going back to the 60s of the United States' support for Israel, the long history of the United States' relationship with the Egyptian military. We have picked all the most reactionary regimes in the region to ally with, rather than genuinely trying to support movements for democracy and human rights coming from the people there.
Obviously, the United States was responding to a horrific attack here on 9/11, and we responded in a way of horror with what happened in San Bernardino. What is the way, and it's understandable on some level that we become terrified that this is going to happen again and people of all faiths are going to lose their lives. Would an understanding of what our role is in the world picture, do we need more than that in response to acts of terror in the United States? It's understandable what the response may be, I think, because, you know, we're chauvinistic in some ways, and we don't want this to happen, even though attacks, horrific attacks, have happened all over the world. But what is the best way to handle those attacks without having a response be the anti-Muslim fervor, which we're going to talk about as this hour proceeds?
Well, I mean, 9/11 was the worst single day of terrorism in the modern era. And of course, it's going to stand out as a day of intense horror. And it's understandable to some extent that we would react to it without necessarily the clearest thinking for a period of time. When you look at something like San Bernardino, though, you have to look at it rather differently, I think. San Bernardino, from one angle, looks like another terrorist attack by Islamic extremists of the same ilk as 9/11, but just on a smaller scale, perhaps. But really, it's about gun violence as well as the apparent link, at least rhetorically, to ISIS that the perpetrators had. It's also about gun violence. I mean, we have a situation in the United States where 400,000 people have been killed in gun crime since 2001. But we just tend to want to focus on cases like San Bernardino, which, with all due respect to the people that were killed and injured in that attack, is a tiny percentage of the number of people killed in gun-related crime every year. I mean, we have incidents like San Bernardino every day in the United States, but we tend not to put them
right
as headlines because they're not seen as terrorist attacks. And what's more, we have more people killed since 9/11 in far-right extremist violence than we have from Muslims in the United States. So I think the way to respond to something like San Bernardino is to say, law enforcement investigation did the perpetrators leave any clues once they'd begun their plot that could have been intercepted by law enforcement, just as we would in any other kind of gun crime incident? The fact that they have referred to ISIS in their rhetoric doesn't really change the mechanics of how the law enforcement agencies should respond to them. It's a matter of, should we have been able to detect the fact that one of the perpetrators had gone next door to buy a gun? Should we have been able to have better record keeping about gun ownership? Those are the kinds of inquiries that I think would be appropriate in the aftermath.
And one final question, because we're seeing this incredible political year, what is the proper response to Donald Trump?
Well, I think Donald Trump is an openly racist candidate, and I think that on the Democratic side, it clearly looks like it's going to be a contest between Trump and Clinton. And unfortunately, from Hillary Clinton, we don't see a clear stand on this, actually, where you don't actually see Hillary Clinton saying that Trump is a candidate that is trying to mobilize racism, and we know the history of that, and therefore we know where that leads, and calling it for what it is. What we see instead is Hillary Clinton making, you know, kind of very pragmatic arguments about, well, you know, if we have a candidate saying these things outright, then it plays really badly in the Middle East and might lead to more terrorism, which, of course, if that's the message that we're using against Trump, then that just reinforces the impression that Muslims are all on the verge of being terrorists. So, you know, I think that we need to, you know, I mean, obviously there's a political campaign going on. People are thinking about messaging a lot. But sometimes, you know, you just have to take a stand on principle and say, we do not accept racism in our presidential election in this over open manner.
We have time for maybe one or two phone calls for Arun, and then we're going to talk about specific acts of intimidation here in the Milwaukee area. Arun Kundanani is our guest, the first part of the hour, author of The Muslims Are Coming, which is a critique of the West, he calls willful misinterpretation of jihadist motivations and violence. He is a professor now at New York University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org. We'll be back and take at least one or two phone calls for him. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I did want to take at least one phone call, maybe two, for Arun, and let's go to Saeed in Green Bay first. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, Kathleen, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
The question of Islamophobia, I want to approach it from a different angle, and that is that in the United States, particularly by the practitioners of cultural relativism, any criticism of Islam is labeled Islamophobic, and that is wrong. When Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who has every authority to speak about the mistreatment that she has endured of under misogynistic practices that are core Islam, okay? When her speech is labeled Islamophobic, okay, when the women in Iran who suffer tremendously for fighting for equal rights bring their plights to the court of public opinion, world public opinion, they have no reception in the American left. And because anyone that criticizes is labeled Islamophobic, that is wrong. Most of the Muslim immigrants, particularly the first-generation Muslim immigrants that come to the United States, know that they are here because this is an environment where they are free, where they are more free in this country than the countries that they came from. I know for sure, speaking firsthand for Iranian immigrants, of whom there are 2 million in the United States, that we are here because of our treatment in the United States is far superior.
All right. I'm sorry, Saeed, but we need to get a response. We have a lot of callers and another guest yet to come. Arun, your response.
I lost the connection a little in the middle of that. But, you know, on the basic point that somehow that using the word Islamophobia means that criticisms of Islam get shut down, I mean, I don't think that's true at all. I think everyone who works with this term, at least in scholarship and in the campaigning work that I've been involved in, understands that criticisms of Islam are entirely valid. Someone who wants to articulate objections to the religious belief system of Islam, no one has a problem with that. The problem comes when you do what Ayaan Hirsi Ali has done, which is to use the concept of Islam as a way to say that everything that, you know, over a billion people around the world do in their social life, in their political life, in their cultural life, can be reduced to the product of what she considers to be, a simple, essentialized, single, dangerous ideology. And that is incredibly reductive. And not only does she, I mean, obviously she's entitled to express that opinion even though it's flawed, but I think what's more dangerous is that she then advocates violence, right, to against Muslims very openly, very aggressively. And so you have someone who is Islamophobic then, and I think that for her the label does apply accurately. Many, many people around the world have all kinds of criticisms of Islam and make those criticisms without being called Islamophobic. Obviously, in countries that are authoritarian regimes, like Saudi Arabia, those criticisms get repressed for political reasons, but they don't and of course we don't support that, but here in the United States, anyone is free to criticize the religion, and I'm an atheist myself. I do not believe in God. I do not believe in Islam. I make criticisms of Islam all the time, but I also oppose racism, and that Islamophobia is a form of racism.
Arun, thank you so much for being with us. Arun Kundanani, he is author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. He grew up in the UK, and he teaches now. He lives in Harlem, and he teaches at New York University. We're going to come closer to home, the next part of the program, and this part of the show, we speak with the president of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition. Janan Najib has been a spokeswoman for Milwaukee Muslims community to media, government officials, interfaith leaders, academic institutions, and many other places. She's a microbiologist by profession. And we're talking with her about a spike in anti-Muslim rhetoric and incidents in the weeks since the deadly terrorist attacks by Islamic radicals in Paris and California. Disturbingly, many of these have happened in schools in this area. We'll outline what they are, why we haven't heard more about this, how schools need to combat this kind of rhetoric, and how everybody and how you go about this needs to have a better understanding of who the Muslims are in southeastern Wisconsin. Thank you very much, Janan, for being with us. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I read these articles that were in the Journal Sentinel, and I thought, you know, we just don't hear very much about these terrible incidents that have taken place just on the street with school children in buses and in schools. How widespread are these kind of acts of nastiness and intimidation and sometimes threatened violence?
I think they're relatively common. The problem is that you don't really hear about it. I think the problem is that a lot of times the Muslim community and families are not willing to come forth and make an issue out of that. They feel targeted to begin with, and so to bring this to the forefront, many of them sort of take it and say, well, you know, as long as it's just verbal, as long as it doesn't become physical, at times it does become physical, but not realizing that that can escalate into physical acts of violence. And we have so many instances across the country where people are being killed and people are being executed. Simply because they appear to be Muslims, and sometimes they happen to be individuals that are not Muslim, like from the Sikh community.
Mm-hmm. You've been reaching out, I know, to schools and asking for plans in schools to combat this kind of Islamophobia. What do you ask specifically from schools?
Well, really to have, first of all, to begin by clarifying their stance as a school, that they have zero tolerance to any type of intolerance, not just Islamophobia. Any type of racism or xenophobia is not acceptable. And to specifically educate both the staff and the students and help them to understand what really constitutes hate speech. The problem is that we're dealing with a time when we have candidates running for the highest office in the country that are doing specifically that. So it becomes very difficult to teach children what is unacceptable when you see individuals that are running for the highest office doing exactly that.
And what's the result of that political kind of rhetoric, that inflammatory rhetoric? What are you seeing?
I think it's mainstreaming hate. I think that what may be, you know, about even 15 years ago, even directly after 9/11, might have been considered unacceptable, something that's going too far, I think it's just being mainstreamed, and it's becoming so commonplace where individuals feel really comfortable talking about Muslims in ways that they would never talk about any other ethnic or religious or racial group.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about some of the incidents, because I don't think they're widely known in this area. What's been happening?
Well, even as a Muslim community and as Muslim organizations, most of it is coming as anecdotal and as stories. A lot of times when we as a community have events, for example, or we have instances where families are coming together and we start talking about Islamophobia, then we start hearing from families that, oh, yes, my son or my daughter in school encountered this, or, you know, at the grocery store, I encountered this. Unfortunately, we have not as a community sat and said, okay, we want to keep statistics. We want to really try and get these statistics so that we know what we're dealing with. But we can't say that this is becoming very common. It's very common at schools in particular, and even in places of employment where individuals, you know, may be working, and if they happen to say something just unrelated to anything that someone finds, you know, that objects to, they'll say, well, you know, you're really because you're a terrorist or something of that sort. So these are becoming, you know, issues that are problematic, because I think that this is going to lead to polarization in our community and in society. And we are seeing it, I think, at a national level, even politically. You know, individuals that I think were in the shadows because it was not politically correct to be racist or xenophobic have come to the forefront, and they've come out in numbers. And I think we're seeing a lot of ugliness in society right now.
How do you respond to that? How do you respond to that kind of ugliness?
You know, I think that at least what we're doing as an organization and across the Muslim community is really trying to find opportunities to interact with the broader community, to do educational types of seminars and workshops. We collaborate with a lot of different groups to put on educational type of events. And I can say that the requests for us to be out there have been increasing, because there are quite a number of people, a lot of people that are good, decent people that are very troubled by this. And they see this as really not something unusual, but reminiscent, unfortunately, of the history of our country when it comes to intolerance against different groups.
We welcome phone calls for you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we're talking about Islamophobia, how prevalent it is in our community, and how it is countered. Janan Najib is our guest, president of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Marty is our first caller for you in Kenosha. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. You know, at the beginning of your program, you mentioned about some guy that made some comment to two young girls that, you know, if what's to keep me from, give me one reason why I shouldn't kill you.
Mm-hmm.
How much you want to bet he goes to church every Sunday and calls himself a Christian? I can assure you it isn't any atheist making a comment like that.
Well, we don't know. We don't know what his religious background is, but there is certainly a lot of hypocrisy that people may be profess to be religious and then harbor these kinds of views.
Yeah, I agree with that. Unfortunately, I think that that's, once again, I keep going back to what we're seeing happening on the national scene with candidates. Some of the individuals that are really espousing some of the most hateful rhetoric are individuals that claim to be incredibly religious, mm-hmm. and that is troublesome. But then again, I would not want to stereotype Christians, because I think that as Muslims, that's exactly what's happening to us.
Yeah, do you feel like you have to speak for all Muslims, which obviously you can't, but it is as though a whole group of people who are quite varied have been blasted with this, you know, we don't want to let you in the country, all of you Muslims. There are so many individual thoughts. There are so many individual ways of worshiping, and there's so little understanding of the Muslim faith, I think, in this country.
Right. And Muslims are a diverse group. They're not a homogeneous group. There's various, as in with any other religious group, there's various levels of practice and you don't have an individual that necessarily may look Muslim, maybe woman in hijab, for example, but otherwise it crosses all, racial and ethnic appearances. I think it's just unfortunate that people will take a Muslim and expect them to have to represent all of Islam. That really doesn't happen. And I always, I bring sometimes as examples the crisis that's been taking place even within the Catholic Church with the priests. No one comes up to every Catholic and tells them, well, have you condemned this? What are you doing about it? Is this your religion? But it seems that for Muslims, this is something that people tend to do. And I think part of the reason is that there is that lack of understanding about Islam. They're just, a lot of people don't realize it's an Abrahamic faith. They don't realize really the connection with Judaism and with Christianity. And I think that, too, again, it goes back to the idea that we have this history of intolerance. And I just want to just share a story with you. I had a woman that I've known for many years, wonderful, incredibly intelligent woman. She's an older woman. And she was telling me that her grandson is a Trump supporter. And I was quite baffled because I know that she's an extremely progressive, intelligent woman. And she said, I bet that quite a number of the people that support Trump are just like my grandson. And I said, well, what is that? Who's your grandson? She said, well, he's a dropout of school. He dropped out of school. He hasn't kept a solid job. For the most part, he blames everybody for his problems. And I think that this is a certain base core constituency that we're seeing also coming forth. Individuals that maybe for whatever reason sometimes, have not succeeded in certain things and they want a scapegoat. And so some of these individuals are really feeding that fear and feeding that hatred and creating this problem that we have.
Thanks for the call, Marty. Let's go to Janet in Shorewood. Hi, Janet.
Hello. I just want to say, once a month at the Muslim Women's Coalition, Janan and a group of other wonderful Muslims run a brunch, and it's open to the public. I have met Janan for the last 5-6 years. She is the most outstanding woman and spokesperson in our city, and I just feel so painful when I hear anything against her or against the Muslims or anything, because through the Interfaith Conference, we have had so many great dealings with all the religions, and she is the epitome of a person that you want to hold up. And I just, like I say, I feel sad when I hear people are against the Muslim community, because we have a beautiful community here in the Milwaukee area. And she, instead of being home taking care of her kids once in a while, but she has other people doing that, her husband and that. But, she will be out in the community talking and telling others, why we need to open up our minds and embrace each other. She's just a loving person. I feel so great that you have her on here, Kathleen, today. I'm a Unitarian, and of course I encompass all the faiths in my religion. And so Janan is an example of a woman that really has a lot to share with our world.
Thank you, Janet, very much. Very complimentary words for you, Janet.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Janet. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about these acts of terrorism that have taken place, because somehow, people are not nuanced in their thoughts about things frequently, but what they have seen are some horrific acts of terror in the last few years, and certainly on American soil on 9/11. That they have associated with a very radical group who claims Islam in a really twisted version of Islam for their acts of terror. And it's so people have lumped together those acts of terror with these people who claim Islam as, you know, the reason and their desire for a caliphate. So what do you do with that? What do you do with a group of people who are really bad people who claim your faith?
Well, I think it's important, once again, to educate individuals. And this is not just particular to Islam. Unfortunately, this is a problem that I think, certain parts of society and certain media sources and certain politicians have really used to garner support for their own causes. The problem is, while this is horrific, we need to really put it into perspective, because since 9/11, there have been less than 100 incidents of killings by terrorism. 100 since 9/11, less than 100. And actually, more of them have been by white supremacists and Christian militias. If we put that also into context, that in the last 10 years alone, there have been about 355 mass shootings in which four or more individuals have either been killed or injured. And then again, in the last 10 years alone, more than 250,000 incidents of deaths by gun violence. When you put that into perspective, you realize that while terrorism is horrible, It just doesn't add up. I think that we're taking a look at something and creating this hysteria where it doesn't need to be, because most of the terrorist acts and most of the people that are really suffering from terrorism happen to be overseas. And in many cases, the reasons for that have been a lot of times our policies that have created these Frankensteins that are now in power because of the vacuums that we have left in some of these countries.
And yet, the image that we hear is religion justifying some of these actions. And so, how do you dissect that? In your mind, what do you do with that? What do you do as somebody who is a spokesperson for the Muslim community and trying to get people to understand this? Because it seems to me as though that has to be understood in some way to move beyond it, to get the association out of people's minds that this is an Islamic thing that's happening.
Right. And there is nothing within Islam that would justify this type of violence. And all we have to do is look at the life of Prophet Muhammad and how he lived, and even under torture and under oppression, how he continued to live and never really did anything that was unjust. And just because individuals want to couch their acts within faith in order to give it legitimacy doesn't mean that everyone has to buy that. And this is a problem. Whereas the vast majority of Muslims in the world, we're talking about 1.6 billion Muslims, have discounted these acts and have said these are not Islamic acts. The problem is you have Islamophobes that are insisting these are Islamic acts. And what these Islamophobes are really doing is giving justification to the terrorists themselves by claiming that, yes, your acts are Islamic acts. And so this is problematic, because the justification is not coming from the Muslims. It's not coming from the faith of Islam. It's really coming from the Islamophobes that are calling these jihadists or calling it Islamic terrorism, giving it these definitions. And that's a problem.
Lori in Madison. Hi, Lori.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking on the subject. I want to bring up one specific instance that I think is related. Kathleen, forgive me, I came in late, so I'm not sure if you've discussed this already, and this is the instance of the manufacturer in Wisconsin where there are Muslim employees who needed to take time in order mm-hmm. to make their prayers, and they were summarily basically fired, at least so far as I could tell. Have you discussed this subject already?
We have not.
Okay, well, I want to bring this up as an instance. Now, to my mind, especially with the way that the Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage galvanized people into talking about the need for freedom of religion, etc., I didn't really hear any public Christian figures who had spoken out, and this would include politicians in our state, come out and speak forcibly on practice their religion. And it strikes me that allowing this kind of denial to go on in a very, very public way like this, without expression of support or whatever from our public officials, and we need to remember that our governor at the time that he was a candidate for office, he himself was very cagey in his statements about Muslim extremists and whether they could be considered, or about Muslims in general and whether they could be considered a bit, whatever. Well, we remember that. But in any event, I'm just concerned about the lack of public comment from our elected officials, and I'm wondering if you have suggestions as to how we, the citizens of Wisconsin, can help to make those public officials more accountable to the extent that they at least make statements.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lori, for the call. Janine?
Well, I absolutely agree with your caller, and I think this is a perfect example of where we carry different yardsticks for different individuals and different groups of people. I think it is really important for people to stand up for what is right. One of the problems that I have encountered, even amongst some of the faith communities that you would expect would come forward on certain issues, at times they themselves are worried about being targeted by right-wing extremists themselves, or having their, for example, their church or their mm-hmm. denomination targeted because they might be standing in support of Muslims. But I always say that as a person of faith, that this is something that particularly within the faith community, it has to take place. And I think it is important for citizens to really call their elected officials and tell them, you know, we think this is wrong. We're not Muslim, but we think this is wrong, and we think you should say something about it. And until it really becomes out in public and more people talk about it and more and more people realize that we are having different standards for different people, whereas certain groups, you know, we want to give them every opportunity to be able to freely practice their faith, yet others, we're trying to control that. Until this becomes very public and people are able to make that connection and see the differentiation, it's going to continue. So I do agree with your caller that this is something that we need to change.
Thanks, Lori, for the call. We'll take a couple more if we have time for it in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go next to Sean in Randolph. Hi, Sean.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much, Kathleen, for this program. As always, well done. But I actually felt moved to call in as a Christian woman, and it bothers me so much that other people that claim that mantle speak to anybody with such disregard and disrespect and judgment and hatred, because that is not part of my faith. And that feeds into one of the previous callers who spoke so harshly as a Christian goes to church and an atheist would never speak that way. The fundamentalist Christian right does not speak for me as a Christian woman. And right after I called in, you were talking about that, how people of the Islamic faith, men, women, and children, do not want ISIS and those extreme groups that are trying to claim power and not faith of love and compassion, because there's a big difference. They don't want that claim either.
Chinon.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, I think that there are tremendous, tremendous number of Christians that are wonderful, caring, compassionate individuals that are living their faith appropriately. And I think I absolutely agree that I personally, as a Muslim, don't feel that some of these right-wing Christians and some of these individuals that are really promoting hate, that they represent Christianity any more than ISIS represents Islam.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a really interesting hour. Thank you, Janan.
Thank you for having me.
Janan Najib, she is president of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition, and she speaks widely in this area to people like us and to people in government, interfaith, people at various churches and synagogues, etc. She speaks to academic institutions, hospitals, community groups. She is a microbiologist by profession and believes there's a real need to bridge the gap between the perception of Islam in society and the actual beliefs and practices of the vast majority of the world's Muslims.